Welcome to Commonplaces, a podcast of Protestant resourcement. Commonplaces is brought to you by the Davenant Trust, where we are committed to the renewal of Christian wisdom for the church today. I'm David Cooper, the host, and I'm coming to you from Lynchburg, Virginia. This week, on the eve of the 499th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, I'll be talking to Pastor Stephen Wedgeworth about the impact, legacy, and celebration of the Reformation. Pastor Wedgeworth is the pastor of Christ Church in Lakeland, Florida, and he also runs the website, The Calvinist International. He's an excellent scholar and pastor, and I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. Stephen, welcome to Commonplaces. Good morning.
Good to be here. Yeah, good morning.
So I wanted to have a conversation with you. It's mid-October. We're coming up on the 499th year of celebrating the Reformation. And I feel like in the last couple of years, I've seen some pieces from Protestants who have been a little bit more negative on the Reformation and speak of it more in terms of lamentation rather than celebration. And I want to get your perspective on that. Do you think the Reformation, almost 500 years out, is something to be celebrated or lamented?
Yeah, good question. I'm familiar with the pieces that you probably have in mind, and it's a conversation that has been happening on and off really since the Reformation. My point of view is that the Reformation is still something that we ought to celebrate. We should do so, I think, carefully, make sure that we're paying attention to everything that is relevant. But at the end of the day, I think it's celebratory because it was a correction of serious errors, errors that we have the luxury to sort of step back from and evaluate good and bad, maybe a little bit of both, but had they not been corrected, we'd be in a very different situation. And it really gave birth to the modern world, and you know, you might say, well, already that's a bad thing because we're living in a time when people are critical of the modern world. But again, I would just counter that the modern world has given us the luxury to have that kind of self-critical attitude. We take for granted some of the things that we wouldn't have even been able to do. And so, specifically, the Reformation gave us the ability to have what we would consider sovereign nation states that were free from an imperial control. And this gets into some of the history of how Europe developed.
Can you connect for me that what are some of the dots between, you know, the early part of the Reformation, Luther's action, and then the creation of sovereign states? Or who are some authors that do that history well?
Yeah, well, there are lots of writers who have talked about the sort of the conflicts between, say, prince and king, magistrate and pope. And so I think, not that he's entirely 100% sympathetic, but Eugen Rosenstock Husey, in his book Out of Revolution, he kind of talks about the papal revolution and how that set the stage for Renaissance and Reformation sort of counter-revolutions. And then that gets followed up by Rosenstock's student, Harold Berman. And he writes books that are really hugely influential in the academy. You know, political science, philosophies of politics. People read Berman all the time. He's got the two-volume set called Law and Revolution, where he really works out the implication. And then more recent kind of theologically attuned writers, Oliver O'Donovan would certainly be someone who talks about this development. John Witta, from Emory here in the States. Those guys are writing a lot. One very interesting writer, he came out with a book a few years ago. His name is, pull it off the shelf, Eric Nelson. He has a book called The Hebrew Republic.
Okay.
And just by that title, you may not know what he's getting at, but when you look at it, he talks about the ways in which English Protestant theologians and philosophers recovered, he uses the word Hebraic, but we can translate that Old Testament
sure.
View of politics, of statecraft.
Okay.
And it's really fascinating, the stuff that he shows and digs up. And so there's a lot of interesting work happening right now. One of the friends of Devna Trust, a contemporary writer and professor that comes to mind, is Glenn Moots.
Okay.
He's got a book called Politics Reformed, where he talks about the way in which Luther, but then also Bullinger and Calvin, really contributed to modern statecraft. So that would be another guy that comes to mind.
Okay, that's it. So you're speaking more of just the privileges we have as modern people to just be where we are and enjoy the life that we have. But then obviously there's the theological and biblical freedom too that flowed out of the Reformation. Where do you see that today as far as theologically, the relationship between the Protestant world, maybe in the Catholic world, or just in the Protestant world itself?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. I think you were mentioning sort of translations and scholarship abilities that come with that. Obviously, that comes to mind when we think of early reformers like Tyndale and even Luther translating the Bible. But what I would say is, on a real level, we are all Protestants now.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there really are no major theologians or biblical scholars who are afraid, hey, if I do this study, if I write this book, am I going to get, in major trouble, both spiritually and temporally?
Okay.
Nobody lived under that fear, right? That we pretty much all have this conviction that it's good for faithful Christians to be able to investigate difficult questions and then have a conversation together.
Mm-hmm.
We can worry about the excesses, no rules, and just running off with speculation and imagination, but I don't know anyone who today who says, what we really ought to do is get an ecclesiastical committee together, and they'll pre-select what should or shouldn't get out there.
Mm.
No one.
Yeah. So how do you personally, in your church, as a pastor, and in your family, how do you celebrate the Reformation?
Yeah, well, it's the church where I minister, Christ Church of Lakeland, Florida. What we do is we do a couple of things. So on the Sunday closest to All Saints Day and Reformation Day, we have a special liturgy. And I really combine those 2 days, All Saints Day and Reformation Day.
Yep.
Luther chose that day on purpose when he put the 95 Theses out there. And so I start off with All Saints Day. We're celebrating the memories of Christians who've gone before us. And Reformation Day is one great illustration of that. Here are some of our most sort of cherished, influential, closest neighbors in the faith historically, and what can we learn from them? And so in our liturgy, we will reflect that. So we'll have hymns that are both about the early church, and we'll do For All the Saints, but we'll also work in Mighty Fortress of Our God.
Sure.
Then we will have a time after the worship, usually in Sunday school. We'll get Sunday school hour. And I've actually stretched this out into something of a season. So we'll do 3 to 4 weeks where we'll cover biographical sketches of certain key figures. And we've done the highlights of the Reformation, Luther, Calvin, Knox. And then we've also taken the time to do a little bit of pre-Reformation and even sort of socio-political connections to the Reformation. So I would feel liberty to talk about certain kings and princes and wars and civil actions that happened because of the Reformation. So try to paint that whole picture.
Okay. Is that mostly in the continent or the British Isles or a bit of both?
Yeah, well, it definitely includes England, the various revolutions and advances within England, but also the Dutch Reform have a very interesting history, and some of this I'm still learning. We all know that hymn, we gather together to ask the Lord's blessing.
Sure, Thanksgiving hymn, when we use it, yeah.
Yes, Thanksgiving hymn. Well, I was tickled to death to find out that that hymn has its origin in the Dutch Protestant Revolutionary War against Imperial Spain.
Okay.
And so the gathering together that they're doing in that song is gathering for Protestant worship.
Ah.
It was illegal.
Okay.
It was illegal at the time.
Okay.
And after the Dutch Revolution, which is a really great story, there's these pirates, if you don't like them, and if you do like them, you know, you call them, skilled Navy captains, privateers, right?
Sure.
But they actually helped lead the Dutch army against the Spanish, and they were called the Beggars of the Sea. So the audience definitely go look up the history of the Beggars of the Sea.
Okay.
And in their fight against the Spanish, they knew they were outmatched on land, but the Netherlands. And so they actually orchestrated this series of maneuvers where they took down or, pulled out the supports or even smashed them themselves. They took down all of the dikes and the dams and intentionally flooded their own country so they can extend their naval forces.
Wow.
And they can use their ships to fight the Spanish.
Okay.
A great story. And then that hymn, We Gather Together, became almost like a national anthem, but it was a national anthem that directly connected their society to Protestant Reformed religion.
Okay.
So, yeah, what a neat story, and a hymn that most all of our churches sing all the time.
Sure.
Probably don't know the history.
Yeah, I mean, it makes it more appropriate to be singing that even into October. We generally sing that more in November. so that's great. Okay. So you guys do some emphasis on teaching on the Reformation. Do you have any particular parties or dances to celebrate the Reformation?
At a church where I was prior to here, in Jackson, Mississippi, we did have a full Reformation Day party, and it was a lot of fun. We would have carnival games, and we would sort of make cardboard cutouts and decorate it as if it were a medieval or Renaissance time, and we even did reenactments of the one year guy. Played John Knox in a great Scottish accent, very entertaining. So I had a lot of fun with that, and that'd be something maybe in the future we could do. Right now, our church, we haven't done that because of just some practical issues where this year we're having a conference with Mark Jones is coming from outside to speak to us, and that's going to be happening kind of close to the same time.
Sure.
So we could feel like we could really, it would be a good idea to try to take on another big activity right then, but something we keep in mind for the future probably. We do have as our normal once a month fellowship meal, and we'll kind of dedicate that to the Reformation, and we'll I think last year we did German food.
Okay.
bratwurst and some good beer.
Yeah. So is there a danger of triumphalism around our celebration of the Reformation, or is there a danger that we're building walls with, Catholics or other, maybe even our Lutheran brothers and sisters as far as the way that we celebrate it, or do you not see that as much of a danger?
Well, there's always a danger with triumphalism in any sort of team spirit activity.
Mm-hmm.
We see this in just our own nation's history. Should you celebrate the 4th of July or should you not? And so there's always a danger of that. And if we're telling our Reformation story entirely one-sided, good guys, bad guys, white hats, black hats,
yeah,
then yes, that's going to be a problem. I think it would be very unwise and probably even unchristian to dig out our nastiest Martin Luther quotes or our favorite sort of Northern Irish parade hymns and start really blasting that on Reformation Day. That would probably be a bad idea. So we need to be sensitive to that. However, at the same time, I think we still need to just be honest. If we act like there were no problems and that this was all just such a disaster, then we will, A, not be telling the truth, but B, we'll create divisions with other kinds of people. The Catholics are not under any illusion that we are divided with them. And so for us to remind them, oh yeah, by the way, there was a Protestant Reformation, that's really not my news.
Sure.
They know that. They're not shocked by that. And as long as we're doing it, I think, in the right spirit, trying to promote why we think it's good,
mm-hmm.
if we have appropriate humility, then I think that they will understand that, just as we would understand when they have days in which they promote their heritage.
Okay.
So I think that there's a good way to do that. It's sort of like, would you rather an ecumenical gathering be one in which everyone pretends that they no longer disagree, or would you rather them be very honest with disagreements but try to do so in a kind, charitable manner?
Yeah, probably take the latter.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And in my experience, the Catholics who are most sensitive and fragile even to Christ and celebrating their Christ identity tend to be kind of the more liberal Catholics. My Catholic friends and acquaintances are very traditional minded and very very rooted in historic Catholicism. They're not put off or offended when I'm also traditional and rooted in my Protestantism.
Mm-hmm.
They say, yeah, we respect that. We understand why you would be that way, and we appreciate your honesty. It's usually the Catholics who are trying to paper over differences or let's just pretend that we can move on without settling differences. Those are usually the ones that are most likely to get upset and offended. And so I think we can be unified in more than one way.
You
identify with people who we have disagreements with, but agree on the way to have the conversation.
Sure. One thing I've appreciated about you is sort of what you alluded to earlier, is you said specifically, which is the honesty about our own history, not necessarily papering over all of our own, you know, warts or issues, and being self-critical at times, but not, but also being able to still celebrate the good, you know, and it doesn't become a self-hating movement either. We can both be.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, I hate to admit this, but according to what the internet tells me, I am a millennial.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm a millennial.
Yeah.
And so I want to be very attuned to the dangers and temptations that millennials fall into.
Okay.
One of the biggest ones is this self-loathing. You know, let me tell this story about how bad mom and dad were growing up, and I've learned all of these problems that finally I'm shaking off and I've become enlightened. Right? I mean, that's all over the place.
Yeah.
And so I need to be sensitive and aware that that's probably in my just cultural bones in a much more acute way than, you know, overly patriotic sentiment or overly pious appreciation of my forefathers.
Yeah. So how have you cultivated then a spirit of appreciation for history? I mean, can you give me a little bit of your, when did you become a very self-consciously, you know, Reformed Protestant who cared deeply about the Protestant tradition?
All right, so now I get to be a millennial again.
tell you
my story.
Yeah.
I'll try to condense it. So I was in seminary, and this was during the height of theological controversies. And so.
Now, wait, that doesn't give us any specific chronology, right? Isn't that everyone's seminary experience to some degree?
yeah, I'm sure a lot of people would say that. So, I'm in seminary, to be very specific. I'm going to Reformed Theological Seminary in Jackson, Mississippi.
So,
a conservative Presbyterian, and particularly Southern Presbyterian kind of flavor. While the OPC and the PCA are writing their reports on the new perspective on Paul and the federal vision. And so those items are all in the air. And the topics generated by those conversations, whether rightly or wrongly so, they became conversations about justification, the efficacy of the sacraments, the relationship of the visible and invisible church, how one understands their salvation, and then what is or is not confessional within the bounds of the Westminster Standards of the Three Forms of Unity.
Okay.
And so I'm coming of age, so to speak, getting my theological training while all that's happening. And so I felt the tug of war there, which was a good tug of war. Biblical studies, being faithful to the text of Scripture, and understanding the role of hermeneutics and presuppositions and church tradition in our reading of Scripture.
Okay.
How do you work that out? And so most of the PCA crowd was pushing for sort of a very strict attention to the Westminster Confession. Let's make sure we're reading that and the catechism's being faithful. And so I felt the power of that argument. But what I quickly discovered is that, wow, the Westminster Confession and catechism are really much more interesting and complicated than anyone's letting on. And as I started digging around and reading other scholars, you find out, wow, there were 2, 3, 4, 5 different views maybe on any given topic.
Hmm.
And ironically, to some people, I would say that it was several of the proponents of the federal vision, men that I count as friends, but who their critics would say are non-traditional. It was many of those men who kind of clued me in to some of these forgotten lineages. And so remember Joel Garber has an essay, it may still be online, about the early Scottish Protestants and their doctrine of baptism. So I remember being fascinated by that.
Okay.
And through Rich Lusk had done some work on Twiss and Gadiger and Vines and their relationship to the Westminster Assembly, and even Cornell Burgess in his book on baptism. And so these are fairly traditional sources,
mm-hmm.
containing very interesting material. So I started reading and enjoying what I found. And then around the same time, I started teaching at a classical Christian school.
Okay.
And I had to teach classical and medieval history. And so I was drawn right into those sources.
Okay.
So the world started to connect. I started to say, oh, the Westminster Confession of Faith didn't fall out of heaven from nowhere. It was written by men who had certain issues and motivations, who were responding to other men, who were responding to other men and events. And, you know, you start seeing the collage of everything. It became very exciting and also freeing, because it's a history that doesn't shackle you and say, well, I can only give you the correct answer.
Okay.
But the history that opens up more categories.
Because you can enter into the conversation and kind of see the genealogy of it? Is that what helps it open up? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think that's one way. You say, oh, okay, this is why this question was even relevant.
Okay.
But even more basic, it just shows you there were always 2 or 3 different and acceptable answers to several of these questions.
For the men who wrote that, I mean, yeah, so it was meant as a document that it would include multiple positions. Is that am I understanding you correctly there?
Oh, absolutely. It's you can say a consensus document, but it was a consensus document particularly to unify as many Protestant Christians as they felt could be unified.
Okay.
That's part of the goal. And one guy that comes to mind here is Professor Richard Muller. He's showing this now, that the confessions were certainly meant to exclude particular items that were deemed to be heretical.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. But there was a much larger grouping of diversity that was deemed acceptable.
Are you, when you read Muller, is that in the post-Reformation Reformed Dogmatics or in other standalone works that he's doing a lot of that work?
Well, the post-Reformation Reformed Dogmatics is sort of like the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, everyone should have it on their shelf, but very few people are going to read it cover to cover.
Sure.
So, the book that the place you could start, and then this would open up to others, is his most recent book. It's called Calvin and the Reformed Tradition.
Okay.
And that's new, that's the most sort of recent book, but that has some really good summaries of his overall project. And I think it's his opening chapter, it's either an introduction or chapter one. He recounts basically what he's been working on. He tells his sort of the history of his scholarly program.
Okay.
He summarizes it quite nicely.
Okay. So, we're coming up on nearly 500 years. How do you make a broad brush evaluation of where sort of the Reformed Church is today?
Yeah, that's hard. We need to define it.
Yeah.
What is the Reformed Church?
Sure.
Is it capable of being singular? So I would say clearly there's been a lot that's changed. We don't have any sort of cultural superiority or primacy. We can't point to institutions that have big public influence that are reformed in a meaningful way. So we have to admit that. In one sense, we've really lost any sort of primacy or even perhaps relevance,
which is
tragic. But at the same time, if we kind of get a little more, we zoom in a little bit closer to history, I would say, let me spin it another way. If you were a thinking Protestant layman looking for a good Reformed church, let's say in the 1980s, or even early 90s perhaps, how likely, unless you lived in a really, you know, just providentially convenient area, how likely is it that you could find a biblically faithful but also intentionally Reformed church in your general area within driving distance? You know, how likely would that be? Can I find someone who understands A, what Calvinism even is,
mm-hmm.
B, has a general philosophy of the covenant and the church and sacraments, and is actually trying to incorporate that into their ministry?
Yeah. Well, I can tell you my own experience in the late 90s in Lynchburg, Virginia, was I could find one such church, you know, when I moved here. So, and now there's probably half a dozen.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's a lot more options now. I think of my own experience growing up in South Mississippi, the answer would probably be zero.
Okay.
You know, there may be one per, you know, 100-mile radius. And so, not that it's exploded to where there's one every block, but yeah, there are more now.
Uh-huh.
In this part of the state of Florida, the reality was you had one or two, you know, mainline Presbyterian churches, and that was it. And those were probably on a progressive liberal slant.
Sure.
Now, we're not like we're just exploding in them, but I think of just in my city of Lakeland, Florida, there are, I think, 6 or 7 sort of Reformed Presbyterian-ish options.
Yeah.
And a handful of Reformed Baptists or Reformed, you know, more broadly evangelical options.
Yeah.
So that's pretty good. I think we should rejoice in that.
Definitely.
And the ability to do more of that. I think we're all fairly confident that as the Lord sort of looks favorably on our small work and as we get more people and more resources, there's no reason we can't encourage more churches like that. You know, it's not that it's a given or it's easy, but it's certainly a realistic goal.
Mm-hmm. How do you think... how do you think it becomes more of a reality? What do you think are some of the steps to continue to grow that movement? I mean, one, I get some sense that the young reform restless kind of movement in the more evangelical Baptist world is maybe losing a little wind out of its sails, if you will. I don't know. Is that your sense?
It's certainly, I think there's something to that. It's tricky to predict concretely what will happen, but
sure.
I agree that there's definitely been some sobering moments where you say, okay, this is not simply that unstoppable march of progress. but I think the way that it continues is mature cultivation of specific communities and individuals. One of the dangers of the movement mentality is we just talk about forces and trends and momentum. We're going to have to just get down to the nuts and bolts and say, okay, pastors, invest in people. Take these young men who are showing promise and mentor them.
Uh-huh.
These families, make sure that their marriages are healthy and they have a good relationship with their wives. Make sure the women are empowered to serve in their churches and to have appropriate roles that they can contribute and that they're doing their part as well. Let's make sure our children are having a good experience and are being equipped both intellectually but also spiritually and relationally, that they have friends and there's a good community to be in. I think that's the kind of work we're going to need to do. If we just talk about ideas and cultural turning points, then we're going to get stuck in something of a fiction, something of a journalism or literary universe that's separated from the ground.
That appears to be, I was looking at the conference you guys are hosting in the next week or two, I mean, that appears to be some of the topics you're addressing there, that you don't want to sort of live your church through the blog world, through online sermons, that you do need a true, you know, face-to-face experience as a Christian. You need to be in church on Sunday morning and physically, you know, there worshiping God and receiving the sacraments.
Absolutely. And here's an anecdote that might be helpful. A friend of mine, he's living in South Florida now, so giant population. I mean, I think it's the third or fourth largest population region in the country. And he's looking for a church that should move there. And so he goes to a church that, you know, he has some interest in, but some disagreements, and he's talking to the pastor, and the pastor says, tell me what you're looking for. And he says, I want a church that's biblically faithful and has a sense of seriousness about its ministry and mission. It takes its job seriously. It has a reverential tone to its worship, but where the people like each other and get along. And they have a healthy community. And he said the pastor just sort of chuckled, and he said, I have never known for those two things to work together.
Wow.
I mean, isn't that quite the statement, right? I didn't know for those two things could go together.
Yeah.
You have to pick one or the other. And when I heard that anecdote, I thought, you know, that's probably what a lot of people are looking for. Even if they've never heard of some of our more sophisticated terms, that description right there probably hits a large group of people.
Yeah.
And we create churches and make it, let people know that they're there, and that bring those two worlds together. How do we do that, and how do we let people know they exist?
Sure.
And so the blog world is great. It exposes people to ideas, but they're going to need somewhere to go to church.
Yeah.
They're going to need friends who live in their neighborhood or town. And if they're married or, like myself, young married with young children, they need help.
Yeah.
They need friends and mentors, advice, and that needs to be someone's house they can go to, have supper, stay up late, you know, drinking a glass of wine, sharing what's happening in their life.
Yeah.
So,
that's...
you know, I don't want to say that we're going to pivot from ideas to that kind of stuff. Hmm. But our ideas need to infiltrate that world. They need to help create that world and then promote that world.
How do you see, I mean, you've run now the Calvinist International for a number of years, and that's a very, I would say, you know, ideas-based blog. I mean, it's heady stuff, long articles, you know, deep work. How does that translate into what you're describing as far as forming, you know, Christian character, forming vibrant, worshiping, serious churches that would honor God?
Yeah, great question. It's a question our own collaborators have asked, and sometimes we've had good answers. Hey, we're doing a good job, and sometimes we're getting imbalanced here. We need to focus on being able to do both. But one thing we did, and this is sort of a helpful reminder of the sort of separation of callings and vocations in the Christian world, we decided that we wanted to really aim at a certain group of people. We wanted to target scholars who had an investment and a relationship with their churches, and pastors and informed laymen who wanted to read scholarly and academic works. So we had a strategic point of people we wanted to get their attention with the hope and assumption, and then later on we encouraged them to do this, that they would digest all the work and apply it in their communities.
Okay.
And so we get really excited when someone contacts us and says, hey, I'm a pastor. I love what you're doing, and I'm trying to work some of these ideas into my sermon or Sunday school or community groups.
Okay.
They say, great work. Or, I'm a lawyer, a Christian lawyer, and I would really like to have some sources to work on so that I can maybe back this local policy or support this nonprofit or provide resources to help other Christians in my community who are engaged in public civic work. And so we're a niche in that way. We're aiming at those kinds of people.
Sure.
We're aiming at those kinds of people because we think those people can then do work that we can't do. And they can take it and apply it in a concrete way.
Okay. Well, thank you, Stephen. This has been a wonderful half hour. I feel like we could go lots of different directions, but I appreciate your wisdom and thoughts on these different topics.
Yeah, I appreciate the good questions and feedback. And part of what we're doing right here is just a great example of the vision, having people have these conversations.
Sure.
Hope it's helpful and encouraging.
We'll do it again.
All right. Thanks a lot.
My thanks to Pastor Stephen Wedgeworth for such a stimulating conversation. If you're in the Central Florida region, I encourage you to check out his church, Christ Church Lakeland. The website is simply ChristChurchLakeland.com. I also invite you to further participate in the celebration and recovery of Reformation wisdom at both CalvinistInternational.com and DavenantTrust.org. At the Davenant Trust website, you can also support our work by signing up for an email list or becoming a monthly donor. My thanks also this week to John Ahern for his rendition of Jan Schwelinck's Toccata Chromatica, and to my friend Travis Rogers for his sound mixing. Until next time, I wish you the best as you celebrate the 499th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation.